Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week it's 100 years since the Balfour Declaration. What's that, you say? Well, it's about the creation of the State of Israel. Also, Robin Upton was so annoyed by a mutilation of pages he created on Wikipedia, he created his own wiki. It's called Wiki Spooks. It's all about the intelligence service and the spooks. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, contact the People's Republic, Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street on 0117 909 6897. And I'll give details of how to contact us at the end of the show. Well, I'm joined by David Moat now, and David is a musician. He's putting on a performance of a, I suppose you could call it, spoken word of music. David, it's called Longing, Belonging and Balfour. So tell me about the title. Who's this Balfour guy?
Balfour is Arthur Balfour, who was the foreign minister in 1917 in the coalition government under Lloyd George, who was the prime minister. But he had a long track record of holding office, leading the Conservative Party. He was prime minister 10 or so years before. And he'd been his first job in office at the request of his uncle, Lord Salisbury, was in 1886, I believe, when he was Secretary of State for Northern Ireland and earned the reputation of being Bloody Balfour for suppressing the Irish at that time. That was his first bit in office. And he had a hand in Highland clearances as well, but that was a private matter on his own estate.
Oh, right. That's nasty stuff, the Highland clearances. This is the late 1800s it was going on, and people, some even being burned alive in their own homes to, as a way of evicting them.
There's no record of that as that I've come across on his own estate. In fact, the peasants, the people there, the crofters, are on record with a pro-Balfour journalist as being grateful for the time they were given to quietly go out of their
dwellings. Hang on. Now, this sounds like spin to me.
Yes, so they're absolutely talking, spin, yes.
Oh, thank you very much for giving us such a long time, whatever it is, like 3 hours or 2 weeks to get out of our place and having nowhere to live anymore. Now, I mean, the rights in the Highland clearances were have been there really since time immemorial, whenever people had first settled the land. And it was used as a way to sort of kick people off the land and so that they were then to be easy employed in factory work. But anyway, that's another story. Balfour's much better known for this Balfour Declaration, isn't it?
That's right. Which is very short. I believe you have it in front of you, Tony. Is this the right time to read it out?
I think what we'll just discuss it a bit first, because it's led to what many would consider to be the running sore of a situation in Palestine now. I mean, it was called Palestine at the time. The time of the Second World War, it was under the British mandate from the League of Nations from the First World War times. So the British had charge of it. Balfour was, before that, during the First World War, was a big part of saying, well, we actually think this should be a homeland for the Jewish people and we think it should be Palestine.
That's right. You said it was a running sore, but what we're trying to do in this musical is a very difficult thing. We're trying to see what happened from the point of view of early Zionism and from the point of view of Palestinians. So running sore, complete disaster for Palestinians, but an amazing triumph, a coup for the Zionists, who since 1897 at their first Congress had been looking for this kind of imperial backing, and they achieved it. With
how did they do that then?
Well, that's a fascinating story.
If I was to go to Balfour and say, right, you know, I've got my religion, I want a homeland, give me it, and well, it would probably tell me where to go, wouldn't
it? It was The Guardian what done it, actually. It was C.P. Scott, who was the editor of The Guardian in Manchester, who made the introduction between this biochemist, Chaim Weizmann, who was leading, but well, not the leading Zionist by any means. Herzl, Theodor Herzl, was the famous leading European Zionist, and he was a relatively minor figure on a sort of the Russian fringe of the Zionist movement. But he happened to be in Manchester when Arthur Balfour was given a seat to contest, I forget, in one part of Manchester. And C.P. Scott thought, aha, here's a keen young Jew with Zionist ideals about returning to the homeland, which he supported, as many people did in Britain at the time.
Why did they do that then? Because, I mean, we think of the real pressure being on the Jewish people during the Second World War, not the First World War.
No, the pressure was absolutely immense. If you go back to the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in Russia in 1881, it unleashed a wave upon wave of pogroms against the Jewish communities in the Pale of Russia, which was immense. It was the biggest Jewish population in the world.
So was there any evidence that the Jewish people were behind that, or was this just a scapegoating?
No evidence. No, it's absolute scapegoating. It's very convenient for the Russian authorities, who led a particularly reactionary set up at a time of turmoil and changes, as elsewhere in Europe, to lay the blame for whatever was going on Jews, and regularly, be it the Russian authorities, be it the rather reactionary or very reactionary Orthodox Church and their leaders, it was convenient to do some scapegoating, bloodletting on the Jewish community.
Well, I mean, they've been quite good at that over the years, our leaders, haven't they? I mean, we had the burning of Jews in York years ago. Then we had the scapegoating of Catholics during Shakespeare's time, etc. So it's always easy to point the finger of blame. But so how did he manage to twist the arm of Balfour to get this document signed?
So Balfour was influenced by something called, we now call Christian Zionism. I'm not sure that it's called Christian Zionism then. But there was a guy at the beginning of the 19th century, Lord Shaftesbury, who led a movement, it was, I suppose, Protestant evangelicals, who got very keen on the idea that the Jews had had a hard time at the hands of Christians, which is obviously true, and they deserved to go back to their own holy land, the promised land. It was their place. Now, then, as until recently, still true for many people, there was no concern or notion that people who happen to live there or continually live there, who call themselves Palestinians, had no notion that they had any rights. And the notion of rights is a relatively new thing. And they were not part of the narrative between these well-meaning evangelical Protestant Christians and then later on the Zionists who took succor from this growing opinion in the Western churches. And so Balfour found himself, to his surprise, because he was a relatively recent Russian Jewish migrant to Britain. He actually came from Geneva, like many Russians of his day and generation, educational background. He'd studied in Germany, studied in Switzerland, ended up as a biochemist in Manchester. And he was surprised by the level of support that there was in the British establishment, not amongst the upper class sort of anglicized Jewish communities. They regarded him with great suspicion, but amongst the establishment leaders, Lloyd George, Balfour was the first one he met in 1906, I think it was. He found a lot of support, and so he was pushing at an open door.
Amazing.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Now, was the idea to give the Jews a state in Palestine for themselves, a complete state, or were they just the idea that we'll clear a little bit of space within the British Empire for you?
I think it was very vague and deliberately vague. Yeah. The British wanted to keep their options open. I made a thing of this Christian Zionism and the sympathy with which Chaim Weizmann's Zionism was received. But, of course, there are overarching imperial interests in the British Empire. And the two interests, the Zionism of Chaim Weizmann, the Christian Zionism of Balfour, and these imperial interests dovetailed very nicely. for the British.
Now, we've spoken about two of the characters that appear in your Longing, Belonging and Balfour. That's Chaim Weizmann, the Jewish biochemist or chemist in Manchester. We've got Arthur Balfour. Obviously, he was the foreign secretary. And also there's someone called Ghazala.
In the show, we're trying to do a three-way narrative, narratives that don't necessarily see eye to eye. I mean, they clash horrendously, which is part of the complexity and the reality of the situation. So Ghazala is the name of, in my research, of a Palestinian woman from the village of Al-Jouna, who was interviewed in the early noughties, I think 2006 or 7, who was a girl in 1936 and describes her experience of being expelled from her village in the northern Galilee area of Palestine. And the reason her story is there is that the clearing of her family and the villagers and hundreds of thousands of other Palestinians in 1948 was a direct consequence of the Balfour Declaration, which emboldened and enabled and trained in so many other ways, supported the Zionists who went on to create the State of Israel.
Well, look, let's have a listen now to the Balfour Declaration. It's fairly short. His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the right or political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Now, this is not really what happened, is it? Because many people not only lost their civil and religious rights, and the religious rights are being threatened at the Al-Aqsa Mosque just at the moment, actually, because I think it's every July the Third Temple people come along and say, no, we want to knock that mosque down, please, to make way for our Jewish temple. But a lot of people lost their lives as well.
Hundreds, possibly thousands, no one really knows the figures, of people lost their lives. There were several massacres in 1948, whole villages wiped out. People were terrorized, traumatized out of their homes, in ways that are still need to be reported. And then the villages were soon after erased from the ground in a very deliberate way to remodel the memory of incoming Jewish migrants, the new Israeli citizens. And that remodeling of memory has been carrying on ever since. It's now, you know, it's absolute part of the Israeli citizens' psyche to not face up to the reality that their nation, their promised land, their place of safety in the world is based on this this bloodshed and injustice, which is a very, very tough thing. If I was an Israeli citizen, if I had to face that reality, I would find it tough.
But it's, I mean, a little bit like America, isn't it? I don't know. Britain seems to have given birth to several of these colonies around the world, and the United yes. States. Figures even up to 100 million Native Americans were killed as Britain yeah. and the Spanish were, well, it was actually mostly the British colonized North America.
Yes, absolutely, which is partly why there's, or perhaps largely why there's such a lot of psychological closeness or empathy between America and Israel, because the founding stories are so similar. In fact, Chaim Weizmann, in his autobiography, which I studied for this musical, this concert with story, he at one time uses the phrase "Pilgrim Fathers." The early Zionist settlers he describes as the Pilgrim Fathers of Palestine.
What about, I mean, because we had crusades, didn't we, in medieval times, over to the Holy Land, the British charging off, being involved in that kind of thing. As some people now saying that what's happened with Israel is a kind of a remake in a way, you know, sort of the Crusades too. Actually, probably be the 10th or 11th Crusade or something.
I once had I had a period of trouble in my life, and I had a psychotherapist, a Jewish psychotherapist. And that's what he said. He's an Italian Jewish psychotherapist. And he said, I won't say who it is, but a guy I know well. He said, yes, it's a crusader state. Israel is a crusader state. That's, you know, his analysis of it. It's fairly accurate. I think Christendom wanted a kind of bulwark, a presence in the Middle East against the strength of Islam. I think the so-called, you know, war of civilization, I wouldn't go as far as to say that's a prime factor now, but certainly in terms of the need to control oil and be a thorn in the flesh and to be a sort of divisive element in the potential unity and powerful unity of the Arab people, that was definitely a factor in 1917. And it's a factor today still.
Also, a little bit similar to Northern Ireland, because you had a whole load of people, mostly Scots, went over to fight the Irish with Cromwell. They were told, oh, okay, I'll tell you what, you know, you've successfully beaten down the Irish. Now we're going to give you some of the best land in Ireland. So there's, you know, many of the conflicts in Northern Ireland, ethnic conflicts or religious, whatever you want to call them, are kind of similar. It does seem like we've not learnt our lessons from, you know, what happened in America with the Native Americans, what's happened in Ireland. Still happening today,
and I know that story much less well. I should actually know, as a British person, I should know it better. I know that story less well, but I travelled in the Balkans several years ago, and I found very similar stories with the Serb communities in the ancient borderlands between Catholic Europe, Venetian controlled sort of Catholic Europe, and the Ottoman Empire. They were similarly used and manipulated to be the tough guys, you know, the ultra Christian strongmen, to claim territory in order to be a sort of a barrier to the expansion of the Ottomans. That's in the Dinaric Mountains, and the breakup of Yugoslavia is part of that, and the issues in Kosovo are part of that mentality. It's not dissimilar to the Protestants, I think, or to the Israeli state mentality now.
So the actual date was November the 2nd, is the date at the top of the letter.
That's the date, yes.
Was signed by Balfour, and 2nd of November 1917. The performance is called Longing, Belonging and Balfour. Can you just give us a brief idea of what people can expect if they come along?
They can expect fantastic and evocative music, some of it original, a lot of it carefully researched from that time, some of it of Jewish origin, klezmer, which was the music of Eastern European Jewry. They can expect Palestinian music, and interspersed sometimes riding over a soundscape, stories. Some of these words are drawn straight from the words of Chaim Weizmann, some from the words of Arthur Balfour. There's a famous speech he gave in 1910, where it's a kind of white man's burden speech, where the British naturally had to be the new absolutist rulers because the people of the Orient don't know any different. That's the kind of government that works for them, according to Arthur Balfour, this is. And then Ghazala's words, as she spoke them, we've transcribed them, and the words of several other people. And some of the words also are original. There's Michael Loder, the storyteller who's with the show. He will speak stories of the land, the perspective of the land. We have these passionate human perspectives, people who long for a place that others would argue is not theirs, and people who belong to a place and then are expelled and then long for the place they've been expelled from. So in this passionate human drama, there's a perspective of the land which is somehow dispassionate, and it's a great foil in our production to these human stories and to the music that goes with it. So it's apart from anything else, it's a great show.
Longing, Belonging and Balfour is on this Thursday, that's the 13th of July, 7 p.m. at United Reform Church in Henlees, which is, if you go past the Waitrose, if you're coming from town, or you leave Waitrose on your left, it's about another 10 minutes walk down there on the left-hand side, and it's at the junction of Henlees Road and Waterford Road, just to the left of where the shops are. So, David Moat, Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
Music from Longing, Belonging and Balfour on this Thursday at 7 p.m. at Henley's United Reformed Church. And I'm joined on the line now by Robin Upton from Wikispooks. Now, what is Wikispooks, Robin?
Wikispooks is a wiki, and we're using the same software Wikipedia uses, but it's got a bit of a difference. Our criteria for what is credible material, what is notable.
So, what's the difference between you and Wikipedia, then?
Well, Wikipedia says if it's not on telly or in newspapers, well, how do we even know it happened, and we don't want to hear thanks. So, the upshot of that is if you can control what's on television and keep something off television, you can also keep it off Wikipedia. And that is playing into the hands of people who have long-established methods of keeping things out of the newspapers or off TV. So Wikispooks says, we're going to be critical about everything that gets put here, but just because it's not in newspapers or on TV, that doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't happen. And likewise, Wikipedia has got all sorts of stuff in it which we're not interested in Wikispooks. It's an encyclopedia of deep politics.
So, yeah, we keep hearing these days about the deep state. What is the deep state?
The $64,000 question. Well, it is, first of all, noticed that different people use that phrase to mean different things. So one person's deep state might or might not be the same as another person's deep state. I wrote most of the Wikispooks deep state entry, and I define it, first of all, it's loosely synonymous with sort of shadow government. Some people talk about permanent government. The idea that, yes, you're free to choose, put your mark every 4 years, but the actual individual in Downing Street or in the White House might not be the person who's actually calling the shots. So then, of course, the question is, well, who's calling the shots? And that's the subject of deep politics. If there is a group of people behind the scenes organising control over national governments, then that would be the deep state.
Now, you might say, for example, the bankers have got a very powerful lobby. Obviously, they've got almost unlimited funds as well. So you could start, if you wanted to go and actually stare the deep state in the face, go and knock on a few headquarters of banks up in central London. But where else do you think you might knock on a door and find someone who's a deep state operator?
Well, yeah, deep state, like cockroaches, they sort of hide in the dark. So certainly the deep state needs an ability to stay secret, needs to be able to cover its tracks. So that means, in the first instance, most obviously big media. You're a former BBC journalist yourself. Did you pick up anything about the deep state while you were working for the BBC?
Not a thing.
Okay. I heard a story about you and the Bilderberg. Did you look in the BBC archives about the Bilderberg group on one occasion?
Never, no, because I only really discovered them after I left the BBC.
Okay, perhaps I misunderstood that story. So big media, yes, that's involved, but mostly just at the senior levels.
Well, I mean, it's fair to say, you bringing this up, looking at Bilderberg particularly, because they are one of the most powerful groups in the Western world, really representing a lobby of the big business in the NATO countries.
that if you go back even to the 1950s, late 1950s, just after the group was formed, you'll find on many occasions you'll find actually more coverage in the newspapers in the late 1950s, early 1960s than you will today.
Well, yes. Hats off to, I think this is a subject actually you know better than I do, but I'd say hats off to Charlie Skelton for reporting. And I think the current Bilderberg meetings are actually pretty well attended.
Well, let me just say one little thing about Charlie, because, I mean, he's a comedy writer, really internationally and nationally renowned. You know, some of the biggest TV programs, 10 O'Clock Live, for example, he was a script editor on that program. And he has now found that even The Guardian don't want to commission articles from him. They pay peanuts, so it certainly doesn't give him the, you know, make it worth his while financially to even cover these conferences. It's only a very small amount of money he gets from the Guardian US office that has meant that he can still be writing in anything that even resembles a British press. So he's been completely squeezed out. There are other things that he's been working for example, International Business Times, one or two other small outlets. But, you know, the mainstream press in Britain seems to be almost sanitised of any kind of proper scrutiny for Bilderberg.
Well, this is very interesting. Yes, I mean, I have looked for reports about early Bilderberg meetings and been surprised to find them. And I thought, well, more or less the cat's out of the bag on Bilderberg, so they're going to keep having it because it gets things done. But the action, the real hardcore decision-making, the deep politicians are going to be looking for somewhere else to meet up. Now, maybe they're working on re-censoring Bilderberg. I'd be interested to see how much play it does get in.
I mean, I think that there's just more and more control of the Western press going on right now. I mean, I witnessed some of this at the BBC in the 1990s. Early 90s, you could see things closing down, shutting down, the very best journalists being simply not having their contracts renewed, and programs being taken off the air. I mean, there was just one called Rough Justice, which was looking at miscarriages of justice. We haven't seen anything like that on the BBC for well over a decade now, and the whole thing is becoming a kind of dumbing down process. And the other thing to say about it, I mean, you've got me on my pet subject here, and I'm supposed to be interviewing you, but it's the lack of balance. There's just no attempt at all to give balanced views. I mean, for example, on Five Live, you know, you'll get the Wednesday morning old Tory fossil slot where every week they have a so-called grandee from the Tory party on pontificating about that day's events. That's invariably somebody that the electorate have voted out of office but has still got lots of money, and so they're able to, you know, publish their memoirs and, you know, in between golf excursions. Yep. And there is no balance. This is the thing that bothers me most about it, is that that emphasis has changed from the early 1990s to now, where it is really is just a kind of propaganda service where the corporation is putting out a specific government line, including, you know, basically backwards and forwards phone calls. I've heard, you know, personal people have explained to me that phone calls are going backwards and forwards the whole time all day between the BBC newsroom and Downing Street. So the Downing Street is kind of micromanaging bulletins.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a reflection of a concern that people's imagination is not being sufficiently captured by the media to which they're exposed. I think when fake news websites, when that phrase came along in 2016, I think it was about November 2016, here's a tip, by the way, one way to sort of get a chronology on when this is introduced. I've been looking at the Wikipedia pages. When do they get created? So that told me, I'm onto one of my favourite topics that sort of tailgates with your thoughts about control over the corporate media. I mean, BBC, it's corporate, it's hierarchical. It's actually going to be fairly easy to control, as you mentioned. So the people, you don't need to sort of blow any trumpets, you just fail to renew people's contracts. Or you say, well, we can't pay you for expenses. and you can exert subtle control in those ways. Where the situation's really shifted since the 90s is that people now have the internet that they can use as an alternative source of information. So that has, I think, that's changed the rules in a way that, perhaps the powers that be, those people who are quite interested in controlling what gets published and what doesn't get published, perhaps they weren't ready for this. And this thing about fake news website, and I emphasize that not just fake news, which is what we hear about nowadays, fake news websites came along in November 2016, and I think the original story is, oh, you don't want to get things from the internet because any crackpot can put stuff there, so better just stick to the good old BBC, stick to the TV, stick to the newspapers. You can't just randomly put things in there. That's going to come from an accredited journalist, a professional, somebody who knows their stuff. So that was a story about fake news websites. And quite quickly, that got abbreviated to fake news. So the difference there, fake news website, yeah, well, that means you should be using the old media. Fake news is something that anybody can turn out, including newspapers, including TV. So this phrase, fake news website, that was originally, I think, designed, and I don't know exactly who designed it, the deep state, let's call them that. I mean, just to return to the matter of who are the deep state identifying them, it's not a matter of names and faces for me. It is important to try and keep track as such as we can, but it's a loose group, and the names and the faces keep changing.
Well, you talking about the origins of the fake news phrase, in fact, it was Google that launched their fake news application just 2 days before Merkel and Obama over in Germany in November 2016 officially announced the terrible threat of fake news to the world. So in a way, you've got Merkel and Obama doing a kind of press conference, being spokespeople, or, you know, endorsing Google. You know, that's how bizarre these things are. And of course, Google, if you go back to Google now, you've got Eric Schmidt and his Alphabet company, which owns Google, is on the steering committee of the Bilderberg conferences. So he is now sitting down with Peter Thiel, another steering committee member at Bilderberg, making these kind of high-tech decisions about our future. And it seems that some of our politicians are so witless is that they're prepared to go up and advertise these propaganda ideas for them.
Yes. Well, this fills in some of the blanks. You ask, who else is there on the deep state other than big money? The guys who are in charge of the tech companies, they're in a position of power. So Facebook, all the big data, big capitalism, those organizations have a de facto power. So you want something done, you want some data collected, or you want some software put on somebody's computer, these are the guys you're going to have to get onto. I must mention the intelligence agencies. So-called security services tend to be working for the security of the deep state. If you've got a more or less non-existent system of oversight, as I think most intelligence agencies have de facto, whatever's written down on paper, there may be a committee which has access to these groups, but if the members of that committee are already marked men, if they're in the Bilderberg, if the deep state has got information it can use to blackmail these people, then de facto, that has no effect of oversight. So it's a nexus. I mean, Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex.
Why don't you just do this on Wikipedia? Surely you don't need your own Wikispooks. You can just create pages on there.
Well, yeah, no, you can't, because they'll say, well, this guy, you're interested in him, great, but he's not a notable character. So they remove, I mean, let me think of an example. Peter Jennings, 9/11 witness, was in World Trade Center 7, said some very interesting things about explosions having gone off, about bodies in World Trade Center 7. And he had a page on Wikipedia, and then they said, well, this is not important. He's not a notable guy. We'll take it out. So they did, and somebody else made it again, and they took it out again and blocked the accounts. So Wikipedia is a walled garden. If you're contributing to Wikipedia, well, other people might see it or they might not.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually advise people to boycott it, personally. I mean, it's just, for a start, it's doing the sort of... Peter Jennings, actually, is one of the most, key eyewitnesses of the 9/11 attacks. And he's flagging up something which is not part of the official account, which many people now realise is completely fabricated almost from start to finish. And and so this is an attempt to control history. This is serious Orwellian fascism almost that is going on at Wikipedia.
It is. It is. You've got to be aware that Wikipedia is not your friendly neighbourhood recorder of how things happened. It is very well presented and it's very well referenced. And I would go so far as to say it's trustworthy on a lot of subjects. Because why do you need to lie about those subjects? Yes, there's a... It's an obvious point for PR people and for companies to hit, but it's especially dodgy on matters like 9/11, where that's one of the great lies of our times. So that's really what inspired me to work on WikiSpooks, which is to say the software's great, and I like the presentation. It's got a lot of good things there. It's just this little criterion that if the government says something, well, that's beyond question. And if it's not reported in the newspapers, well, it's not worth having on Wikipedia. So those two elements, this trustworthiness and then this is what's notable, underlie this de facto policy of censorship, which we don't have on WikiSpooks. So we've got a variety of material. I mean, it's a much, much smaller user base and much less visited website, but I think it's got real potential. And the whole site is... downloadable. It's all open source. We're not making any copyright claims that you have to pay a license. If you want to set up another mirror copy of it somewhere, if you want to just pull out a few thousand pages for your own use, then that's all open. Another thing, we record every history. So every change made to WikiSpooks, there's a record when it was made and who made it.
So they do that on Wikipedia, surely?
They do, but... they've started, I think this was a couple of years ago, they've started to remove some of the changes. So at the moment, I think you get a record that a change was made and who made it, but you can't see the change.
Oh, okay.
If it's not the current one.
Anyway, it's fascinating. It's almost like this kind of information war going on the internet to kind of control history. But what's your background? How did you get interested in even wanting to create something like WikiSpooks?
I liked university, and I spent about 10 years at university, and so I was out of the sort of, I heard it called the other week, the Iron Triangle, out of the real pressure of turning up 9 to 5 and doing a job. So it gave me a lot of time to sit and reflect about what I wanted to do with my life. And I decided to go to a third world country because I wanted to see what the world was like, having spent so long in Britain and a couple of other countries in Northern Europe. And I thought, well, this is actually just only a tiny part of planet Earth. Let's see what life looks like from somewhere else. And so I went to Bangladesh, and I found that I enjoyed the pace of life. It's much slower there. Very hard to get things done. The wages are much lower there. Well, actually, that worked in my favour, having done some work in the West. So I was in Bangladesh and got a bit of a distance from Britain. From the consumer society, which was already sort of not really floating my boat, as it were. And I enjoyed spending time, I still enjoy spending time with people. The main hobby in Bangladesh is talking. They just sit and chat, and that it may not be everyone's cup of tea, but I really enjoyed it. I found it a very sort of grounding experience, and one of the reasons, 2003, I was looking after my... It's why I first heard your name, actually, Tony. I was looking after my granny, who had Alzheimer's in 2003. We just got broadband, and I found access to one particular radio show, actually, and I could download it over the internet. It took quite a while in those days. But I found it very thought-provoking. And the show, of course, I suspect you know this, the show's Unwelcome Guests. So originally I was just listening to that and not being trained in sort of politics, not much training in economics, not much in sort of ecological matters. I thought, well, this is really something I can learn from. Didn't understand it all, but knew enough to reflect that these people speaking really knew what they were talking about.
So who were the unwelcome guests in the title of the programme?
The title of the programme was chosen by Lynn Gerry, the American woman who set up the website, actually. It's a website we both know well, radioforall.net. And she chose it just because of the music. But I think her thinking was, well, the speakers, I mean, they had a lot from Michael Parenti, quite a lot from Noam Chomsky in the early shows. These are speakers, Howard Zinn, they know their stuff, but they're not very welcome on corporate media. So let's use the potential of the internet to help these ideas spread a bit wider. So I think that was Lynn's originally what she was getting at when she called it Unwelcome Guests.
Yeah, I'm welcome on the mainstream press. So we're in this kind of bind at the moment, though, aren't we, with fake news? Because this is being used to kind of smear real journalists in a kind of propaganda world that we're living in now, where there's very, very polarised, you know, say, for example, someone like Russia Today, almost battling along on the airwaves with one point of view, battling away with the BBC with an opposite point of view. So neither of them really showing both sides of the argument. And I just wonder whether you think what role fake news has in all that, and do you think it's going to succeed as a term to sort of turn people off from watching corporate media?
Well, I think, no, actually, I think it's backfired, because the original thought, fake news come from these fake news websites, which just use clickbait. They put up some fake stories and expose ads to people, and that's how they make their money. That was the original phrase, and it was just easier to talk about fake news, because news isn't confined to websites, and if you hear news from one source, you can put it on another source. So always concentration about fake news. Now, people who are reading the newspaper, people who are watching CNN. I mean, Venezuela kicked out CNN saying, you're a source of fake news. Well, they're not a source of fake news websites. So it's really, I think it's actually focused people's attention on, do I believe this? Where do they get their information from? And a lot of people, I think people who had already drifted from television and newspapers, why do you seek out the internet? Probably you're already quite sceptical about what you're being told. So I think those people were quite wise to the idea of fake news already. I think the upshot of the whole fake news debacle is currently that it's switched a lot of people on who are watching TV and reading newspapers to the fact that they might be being consistently lied to. So in summary there, I think this is actually a step in the right direction. I think that you're right, they are looking at fake news checkers. They would love to automate this process so that if you post something on Facebook which, say, agrees with CNN, well, then all your friends are going to see that and it'll be pushed up the news feed. And if you have a more critical take, then they'll flag that up in software, because, of course, they can't have armies of people. I mean, they want to try and do the Chinese method, have armies and armies of censors, or the Stasi. Well, they could try, but it's so much more efficient to have software automatically spotting dissident view. This person's used the keyword too many times. Let's flag this up as fake news. But it is, of course, incredibly difficult to actually write an algorithm that's going to parse human language. You think about all, you know, the fact that I could say something to you and be sarcastic, and a computer will just do a text.
Well, you don't tend to get very much on that on the American media. That's almost all literal. So maybe their fake news software won't work over in Britain. Anyway, look, the main biggest fake news ever, surely, was the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Well, if you want to overlook 9/11, yeah. But, I mean, we're not short of fake news. More or less, I mean, how many wars can you think of which didn't start with a piece of fake news?
Well, are you saying that? I mean, they've just had all this stuff to do with North Korea and launching, you know, every month or so there's another missile test, which is the Americans, now Rex Tillerson, the former chief executive of Exxon, banging his fist on the table. I mean, as an example, just forensically looking at that story, you've got Tillerson saying that this is a new threat to the entire world. Well, the thing went, I think it was 930 kilometres, so what's that, about 600 miles? And it could only just about reach Japan from North Korea. And yet on the BBC, they were reporting that this missile can reach the mainland of the United States, exaggerating it, because it's about 5,000 kilometres to Alaska and probably 7 to mainland United States. But this thing only went 900 kilometres. So you can see that there is almost everything to do with the potential future conflicts is being, we're being lied to.
We are. It's scaremongering. It's the 45 minutes to a weapons of mass destruction.
And the question is, you know, the journalists should, at that point where that government, statesperson, whoever they are, makes that factual error, should we politely call it that, then they should be pulled up by journalists, and that is just simply not happening. They are fazed by the power of the people in politics to just simply not ask questions, not do their job. So I guess that's where this kind of fake news ends, is at that point where you just end up with, instead of journalism, you've got a kind of stenography where you're just copying what the government is telling you and putting it out on the mass media as if it's a fact.
Well, I am expecting, I was expecting this year to see a rollout of internet censorship, because they're having trouble dealing with people's free expression, that they want to close down these conversations. I haven't yet seen a great level of internet censorship. They may be having a rethink. But if that is their game plan, just to try and just shut up everybody, we've got to close down this dialogue, I think they're likely to fail, because people want to have these conversations, and because technology is making it easier and easier to exchange information. And as you say, I mean, the corporate media is full of lies, and, you know, people are busy. They haven't necessarily, they're not keeping tabs on this.
But it's a bit more sophisticated, surely, Robin. It's a bit more sophisticated than that, because 90% of what the mainstream press is telling us is the truth, because it's about stories that don't affect those key issues that the deep state wants to affect. It's just when we get, say, something like this North Korean missile launch, you know, it might be the only story in the week which has got so much lies and spins on it.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is, everybody more or less knows that they were lied to about Iraq. Now, I think 9/11, you and I and the people that we hang out with more or less know what a pack of lies that was. There may be lots of people who don't, but the truth is only one YouTube video away.
Yeah, but can you just detail what you think of the basic... I mean, you say lies. I mean, what are you saying is a lie about 9/11?
Well, they claim that it was 19 Muslim hijackers who were organised by al-Qaeda under Osama bin Laden in a cave. And it's hard to know where to begin with that story, because there's so much more to it. I would suggest that it was worked out decades before, planned by people whose aim was to make money, but particularly to amplify their control by bringing in a whole new bunch of laws and using fear to suppress people's rational capabilities, making them become childish and dependent upon the government to protect them from these terrorists. It really launched the war on terror, which is still ongoing, and that's one reason why I've got no time for somebody who says, well, that was 9/11 was years ago, let's move on. No, if our world is still being shaped by this supposed war on terror, a pretty farcical name if you ask me, I generally use that with air quotes, if that is based on a lie, as I believe it is, then we need to get to the bottom of it.
Fair enough. Also, Wikispooks, for anyone that's never used it before, what's one of your favourite pages on there?
Well, the 9/11 page, since we're talking about it, there is quite a lot of information on 9/11. Lots of aspects of it. They're all broken down into separate pages on Wikispooks. So we've got one page for the Pentagon, we've got a page for the hijackers, we've got a page for World Trade Center 7, and then, you know, World Trade Center 7's got sub-pages about the demolition. I mean, in case your listeners haven't heard, the BBC is one of several corporate media outlets who announced that the building had collapsed before it had collapsed. Very interesting, and if I was an investigator really trying to get to the bottom of this, I would seize upon that and say, well, what's going on? This is surely not something that happens. And these various commissions, I mean, I've also...
I mean, just to pick up on that one Jane Stanley quote, isn't it? And she was on BBC World talking about that. You do wonder whether there's someone sitting at the BBC with a script that they're running through. So events like this are effectively almost like theatre, scripted events.
Yes, yes. I think they are scripted. I think they're worked out. People have already got statements prepared. If they know that this is going to happen, and I'm sure that some of the people interviewed were quite ready, and they had thought out what they were going to say, I would encourage people to go to Wikispooks, look at the 9/11 page, and follow their curiosity. We've got about 15,000 pages on the website, and maybe we've got about 30 or 40 about 9/11. As I often do on Wikipedia, I just get curious and I sort of see where curiosity takes me. We have got almost every page on Wikispooks, which has an analogous page on Wikipedia. Some people have been censored, so you can't do this from the Peter Jennings page, but you can click. It's one click away to have a look at the Wikipedia version.
And how do people register? How easy is it, Robin?
You just have to go to wikispooks.net, and that will. It's a read only website until you've made a login. We used to allow anonymous people to edit it. And I would like to do that, but the reality was we just had so much spam and people trying to sell us stuff that it took it was a full-time job, basically, just cleaning it from vandalism and spam. So I'm afraid you have to web to register if you'd like to become an editor, and then you've got to click on Make Me a Login, and you put in a username and password, and you put in your email address, and it'll email you an account, and I have to approve it, or one of the other administrators has to approve it. But it usually doesn't take more than a day or so.
And you might learn something too.
Well, I find that it's very helpful to consume media. When I'm reading things, I half the time I put the interesting bits on Wikispooks. Because you read a story, you read one page on the internet, you say, well, that's interesting. I wonder what supporting references there are. Yeah, these days, if they're referencing documents, if they're talking about documents, but they're not giving you the documents, why not? Because they could be. If the documents are out there, it's just a matter of putting the URL, give people access to the original material, and they can make their own conclusions, and I would think every creditable journalist would try and do that.
The trouble is, of course, a lot of creditable journalists, supposedly creditable, just look up Wikipedia, they ignore Wikispooks. Anyway, look, Robin, lovely to talk to you. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks very much, Tony.
That's all for this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, musician David Mowat, who's doing Longing, Belonging and Balfour on Thursday at 7 o'clock at Henley's United Reformed Church, and also to Robin Upton, the creator of Wikispooks, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, at prsc.org.uk. Also through the National Volunteering website, that's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
dumbo back. Madege dumbo beni pasi pasi. Politiki mani, politiki kolombare. Mwanye farati, politiki kolombare. Obi baby, Oti Fessini, Obi Danobi, Obi Jambassini, give le président, abat le président, vive le général, abat le général,
obeye pour la mogo que le neda, obeye pour la check le neda,
politique mani. Politiki kolombare, mwanye farati, politiki kolombare. Obetere poki la yere safe, katere poki la gigi, obetere poki la yere safe. Tere foki la gigi, obe tere foki, katere foko, katere foki la yere sanfe, katere foki la gigi. Widi yoko, widi ye, widi ye, mwaye panka wene. Why pan kawere, why pan 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 kawere.